Okay, so in November 1922, 10 women were called to the Bar of England and Wales. And they weren't the very first women to be called, because the academic Ivy Williams had been called 6 months earlier. But they did include the first women who intended to actually practice at the bar. And in fact, within a fortnight, one of them would be prosecuting in a criminal trial. That woman was Monica Geikie Cobb. So she therefore became the first woman in England and Wales to hold a brief in court. It was a good omen for her future practice. And in fact, she probably was the most successful of that first cohort in building a legal practice as a barrister. So this evening, I'll explore what led up to that first brief before considering why she might have been so successful in her legal career compared to her peers. So, born in 1891, Cobb was a clergyman's daughter whose eldest brother was a Harley Street specialist. So her background then was pretty solid, professional, middle class. But it was more unconventional than those bare facts might suggest, because her father wasn't any old vicar. He was the controversial rector of St. Ethelburga's on Bishopsgate in the City of London. And he was frequently in the press and sometimes in trouble with his own bishop because of his support for divorce law reform and for allowing divorcees to remarry in church. Much of his activism was related to women's rights. He's been described by June Purvis as an old friend of the women's movement because he'd supported the militant campaign for Votes for Women, and he would speak at Emmeline Pankhurst's funeral in 1928. And he'd also held the unlikely sounding position of first Grand Master of the Order of Women Freemasons because it started out as a co-ed institution and he was one of the initial sponsors. And he was also first secretary of what soon became the Modern Churchmen's Union, which by the 1920s was already supporting women priests. So why am I talking about Cobb's father to start with rather than Cobb? Well, first of all, because it shows that she probably had more encouragement than many young women to engage in higher education and a professional career. However, her father's politics were a very mixed blessing for her. She seems thereafter to have done her best to avoid sharing his notoriety. And indeed, it would have been unlikely to do her many favours at the bar to be associated with someone who was seen as something of a troublemaker. That doesn't seem to have held him back. And I was a little bit surprised looking through press archives to see that he even published a letter to the Times on the church and divorce, nice and controversial, the very morning after her call night. So her call is in the press on the same day as he's banging on about his pet reform project. The family's connections to the law would have been rather more helpful to her, and those included family friendships with some prominent lawyers in London and elsewhere. So eminent solicitor Sir George Fowler's obituary would note that he was both the first solicitor in Bedford Row to brief a woman barrister and, as the legal champion of women's rights, had often shared a platform with the clerical champion, in other words, the Reverend Geikie Cobb. And Cobb's own education and employment also gave her a strong basis for a legal career. So she'd earned a degree in philosophy at University College London, where again she'd showed very little of her father's enthusiasm for politics and controversy. She was the president of UCL's Women's Union Society in 1913-14. But this body was really primarily concerned with institutional matters. So it was fighting sexism within the university, but not really focusing outside the university. And in fact, it very determinedly took no position on women's suffrage And obviously this was the height of the campaign. Cobb graduated from UCL just as the First World War was starting, and during the war she was employed as Joint Secretary of the Professional Classes War Relief Council, whose objects were to ascertain the amount of distress in the professional classes due to the war, and then to organise practical but not financial assistance. And it did that in large part by bringing together a large number of different bodies. And among the many who had representatives on the council were the Barristers Benevolent Association and the General Council of the Bar, as well as various women's organisations, including the National Union of Women Suffrage Societies, the National Union of Women Workers, and the Association of Headmistresses. So it would have been a very stimulating environment for an ambitious young woman, and also must have offered her some useful connections for her future career. And in recognition of her work, it also earned her an MBE, which she was awarded in 1920. By 1920, she'd returned to UCL. She went back to UCL at the end of the war in order to do her law degree. And she graduated, albeit third class, in 1921, by which time she'd already joined Middle Temple at the first possible moment. And I mean the first possible moment for her, basically. The only woman who managed to be admitted before her was Helena Normanton. So those of you who were at last month's lecture will know that because Normanton had been very involved in campaigning for women to be admitted to Middle Temple, she built up relationships with its officers. And so they'd opened the office especially for her on Christmas Eve 1919, the day after the Act got the royal assent. So she was admitted right away. Poor Cobb had to wait over the Christmas holidays until the office reopened in January. And it must have been a pretty impatient wait for her, because the minute the doors were opened, she was the first woman, in fact, the first person to be admitted in January 1920. Some of the other women followed immediately after, so kind of have visions of a queue outside the office door the moment they opened, but certainly very quickly. So as the first women barristers, Cobb and her colleagues face novel issues. So once they'd been admitted to an Inn of Court, then alongside the exams, the other big part of qualification was eating their dinners in keeping terms in the inn. And Cobb wrote a letter to Normanton about this, stating that she understood that Normanton wished to have a separate women's table in Middle Temple for their dinners. Cobb had dined with six other female students, and they were unanimous that they did not want any such action. They felt grateful for the consideration shown to women students, and they wished to fall in with the arrangements that had been made for them. Well, it's not actually clear that Normanton did want a separate dining table. She may or may not have. But the letter does give us some real insight into Cobb's approach and attitude to her seniors in the inn. And indeed, this idea of fitting in was a really important one at the bar. As Sir Ernest Wilde advised prospective male barristers around this time, he tells the young male barrister that if he plays the game, the great brotherhood of the bar will eventually welcome his intrusion as inevitable. So how much more important to smile and play the game if the intruder was not only a newcomer, but also a woman? Because their call to the bar didn't mark the end of these women's struggle to establish a legal career. It marked the start of a new and in many ways more difficult stage of it. Being a barrister wasn't an easy career for anyone to get into. Establishing a practice was hard, and the briefless barrister was a familiar figure around the Inns of Court. But those difficulties were compounded for women. They were doubly untried, both as individuals and as that novelty, the woman barrister. But nonetheless, Cobb, as I've mentioned, made a very strong start. She not only achieved the distinction of being the first woman to hold a brief in court, but she actually won her maiden case. So on the 1st of December 1922, just a fortnight after she was called, because pupillage was optional then, so you could get on your feet straight away, unlike the six-month wait now. So 2 weeks later, Dan goes to Birmingham Assize Court to act for the prosecution in a bigamy trial. The defendant, bricklayer Thomas Fallow, was accused of bigamously marrying while his first wife was still alive. And this was quite an issue this soon after the First World War, because husbands in particular had sort of disappeared and then emerged later. So it was very of the moment. He was found guilty and sentenced to 6 months hard labour. And the media reported this. They were talking about Geeky Cobb. Surprise, surprise, when they reported on her presentation of the case, the first thing they talked about was not her advocacy, but her appearance. So the report said, "Miss Cobb, trim and neat, in her perfectly fitting silver horsehair wig and black gown, was the soul of brevity. The most irritable judge in the world could not have found fault with her. She confined her remarks to the essential points in the charge, every one of which she drove home with clarity and force. The judge and the men barristers around her were impressed, and she was heartily congratulated." That report, on its face, wholly positive, if rather patronising, is actually full of telling details. First, Cobb's silver wig marked her out as a new and untried barrister. And if any of you have read the Rumpole stories or watched Rumpole on TV years ago, I'm showing my age, you'll be familiar with his phrase white wig to describe a very junior barrister whose wig hasn't yet had time to get dirty. And further, though, its exceptional whiteness had a gendered dimension. Captured in anecdotes about the women, shock horror, washing their wigs. So one account, as a well-known bencher said, "We never thought of washing wigs in all our years of contented wear." So the implication is that women were overly concerned about their appearance and overly concerned with domestic details, you know, washing. And failed to understand the masculine culture of the bar, thereby risking its contentment. So that silver wig, actually, there's quite a lot to unpack there. Secondly, the report places this heavy emphasis on her brevity. And that's also actually a gendered dig at women. They were constructed in popular imagination, and really still are, as both talkative and lacking the rationality and self-control to focus their speech. So Cobb's being praised because her conduct of the case is especially surprising in a woman. She manages not to say too much, and yet she's female. And this amazement at a woman being concise would become something of a cliche in reports on the first women barristers. And finally, hearty courtroom congratulations are not the norm at the bar. Normally, if someone's going to say well done in that way, they'd at least wait until the robing room, if they say it at all. So again, it comes across as quite patronising. She succeeded, not because she's won the case, although she did, but because she's reached male standards and impressed men barristers, not simply by succeeding in her job. And that same confusion of positive and negative responses and positive things having problematic undertones can also be seen in Cobb's treatment by her pupil master, a very eminent barrister in his own right with some extremely eminent pupils, Theobald Matthew. She was, of course, Matthew's first woman pupil, being one of the first woman barristers, and so she gets discussed in a memoir written by Matthew's chambers clerk, who says, "He pretended to deplore the admission of women to the bar, yet eventually he took them as pupils. eventually being relative, you know, more or less straight away, in fact. He enjoyed having them and using them as flintstones to his wit. The first one I remember was a delightful young lady called Miss Monica Geeky Cobb. She was a tall, well-built girl. Theo used her as a model in one of his forensic fables, which were little legal anecdotes he published regularly. It was where a judge who, knowing that there was a woman barrister appearing before him for the first time, decided that he would treat her kindly. But because of her size and manner and wig, he mistook her for the blue-eyed young barrister on the other side, dealt gently with him, and gave her a very hard time of it. So pupillage perhaps wasn't easy. Whether she enjoyed being the target of Matthew's wits and his apocryphal anecdotes isn't recorded. His other pupils included the future House of Lords judge, Lord Diplock, Prime Minister Lord Attlee, Lord Chancellor Lord Hailsham, and two Chancellors of the Exchequer, Lord Thornycroft and Sir Stafford Cripps. So it's probably not surprising to hear he wasn't easy on his pupils. His clerk gave a description of a typical day in pupillage. In the morning, the pupils would be given pleadings and opinions to write. Then they would follow Theo over to the courts, where they would listen to counsel in action. And in the evening at 5 o'clock, they would present their earlier work to Theo, who would point out the dreadful errors of their ways. But Cobb, of course, was doing this demanding work in a context where her every professional appearance was liable to be treated as a matter of curiosity to courts and press alike. And so she keeps cropping up in the papers. 2 years later, a snippet appeared in the American press. There seems to be much uncertainty on the part of witnesses as to how they should address the women barristers who sometimes practice in the courts. Miss Monica Cobb, one of the foremost of English barristers, said she was sometimes addressed as Madam, but more often she was addressed as Sir, and she had even been called My Lady. One kind, motherly old lady, she added, had solved the difficulty by calling Miss Cobb My Dear. And while the description of Cobb, who remember is only 2 years tall at this point, as foremost is overly flattering, the throwaway women barristers who sometimes practice in the courts is rather demeaning. And that kind of uneven, jocular tone appears to have been common to a great deal of the press coverage of these women. So when the same story about how she was addressed was repeated a year later in the Australian press, Cobb was termed a counsellor in petticoats. But despite these distractions, Cobb clearly pursued her legal career with real focus. So many of her women peers were politically active. Some, like Normanton and also Crystal Macmillan, had been suffrage activists and continued to campaign for women's rights alongside practicing as barristers. Others took slightly different routes, so another of that first cohort, Ethelbright Ashford, was heavily involved in local government and conservative activism, sometimes at its right-wing fringes. Cobb was also a conservative, but moderate, and as far as I can tell, really not very activist. There are just a few reports of her addressing local conservative branches. She also seems to have spared little time for peripheral legal activities. She did take part in Middle Temple's 1926 mooting competition, where, for the first time in the history of the Middle Temple, women will argue the case. But she doesn't otherwise seem to have been regularly or deeply involved. And Normanton and Bright Ashford both published widely during their legal careers. But while Cobb had written several academic articles before she was called to the bar, the only one I found published after she started practice was a section on gaming and wagering, which she contributed to the English and Empire Digest in 1926. Thereafter, no writing. And what I'm not suggesting is that Cobb succeeded in practice because she was the most focused. It's true that her dedication to law first and foremost can be contrasted with the political priorities of some women. Crystal McMillan, for example, remained at least as much an activist as she was a barrister throughout her life. However, Cobb probably also appears so focused because of her success as a lawyer. Because with legal work taking up much of her time, she had less scope for other activities than those women who had fewer briefs to deal with. And indeed, in 1925, she registered with UCL again, this time for a doctorate in law, but she never finished, suggesting that had her practice not taken off, she too would have directed some of her energies elsewhere into academic research. So I've talked about the success, the apparent success of her practice, because information about it is pretty slim, but there are enough clues to give us some sense of it. So there are some reports of her appearances, particularly in the earlier days. So in July 1923, she appeared as defence junior in a murder case in Derby, and the Leeds Mercury claimed that she was the first woman barrister in the history of British justice to appear in a murder trial. Several other criminal cases appeared in the newspapers, usually on the basis that she was the first woman to appear in the particular court. And they seem, from what we can gauge of them, to be pretty typical of the kind of mixed practice that a very junior barrister would have. For example, in March 1926, she appeared in Oxford Magistrates Court seeking an order for two dogs to be kept under control. The rather improbably named Bingle and Bonzo were bull terriers owned by a Miss McGaw of the Wirehill Ladies Agricultural Colony and had allegedly attacked several other dogs. Miss McGaw's line of defence is one familiar to dog owners. She said that the other dogs had been the aggressors, even if they then came off worse in the fight. Well, didn't work. Cobb gained her order, and at the end, the chairman added that this was the first occasion upon which a lady advocate had taken part in a case at Oxford, and he wished to congratulate Miss Geeky Cobb on the manner in which she had conducted her case. While we shouldn't read too much into her conducting a very low-level magistrate's court case several years after she'd been a junior in a murder trial, because it's not untypical of early practice at the bar, what is notable is the novelty still of having a woman in court. And this by now is 4 years after these women had been called and the first women solicitors had qualified. So it's really a reminder of the fairly slow pace at which women entered the profession. In 1925, when Cobb started her doctorate, she also made comments to the press which indicate why she felt it was a good idea to keep her option of an academic career open. She said that between 35 and 40 women have been called to the bar in England, and only about 12 are in actual practice. A sad statistic, but an unsurprising one, given the hostility that they faced. They don't say much about it at the time, but a woman writing as ER, looking back to those days in 1938, remembered that a friend of mine once brought me a message from a High Court judge of great learning. "Tell her," he said, "that women in the law are matter out of place." This was a very apt description of how they were regarded in the early days. So actually a pretty hostile environment. Now, despite Cobb's appearances in the criminal courts, it was obvious already that her interests were actually in another field of law. So that unfinished doctorate was to have been on the law of banking guarantees. And indeed, she went on to make her name as a commercial lawyer. So in 1931, a slightly gossipy newspaper piece quoted one of the pioneer women lawyers as saying that several have made for themselves successful careers as advocates and pleaders. She specified Mrs. Helena Normanton, who was the first woman lawyer to be briefed in the High Court, and Miss Geekie Cobb. The last name does a lot of important commercial work. Cobb was singled out again in an article the following year, which mentioned her as having done well, and added that in addition to her work as counsel, she has discharged judicial functions as chairman of courts of referees in the metropolitan area. So in summary then, Cobb appears to have established a steady and remunerative legal practice, which is something few, if any, of the other first women barristers achieved. And she remained in chambers until her untimely death after a long illness, when she was only 55 in 1946. And we can only speculate as to whether, had she lived, she might have been called as a QC alongside Normanton and Rose Heilbron, but she never got to reach that landmark. But she certainly seems to have made a more satisfactory living in law than the higher profile Normanton, who had to work hard as a writer and lecturer alongside her practice as a barrister. So why did Cobb succeed in terms of practice when so many other women struggled or too often left practice altogether? Well, ability and dedication alone are unlikely to explain it, because many of these women were able and committed. However, there were other differences between Cobb and many of the other members of that first cohort of women barristers, which differentiated her from her peers. She was younger than many of them, such as Normanton and Ashford. Normanton and Ashford and so on had been waiting around for years to be called. Geekie Cobb was still quite a young woman, so she must have stood out much less than these rather elderly baby barristers. She was also more quiet and moderate in her politics than Ashford, let alone the ex-suffragettes Normanton and Macmillan. She came from a professional background, unlike Normanton, daughter of a piano maker, or Bright Ashford, whose father had moved from selling to manufacturing hosiery. In a profession where qualification was expensive and required a long period of dining regularly in central London, her financially secure metropolitan circumstances can also be contrasted, for example, to those of Olive Clapham. Olive Clapham was the first woman to pass the bar finals, and she really sort of raced through with huge determination as well as ability, passed her bar finals, and then things kind of went wrong. Why? Well, Clapham was the daughter of a deceased printer in Yorkshire, and after her father's death, she'd grown up in her aunt's household in Hull. And so she made fast and determined progress until she passed her bar exams. But then she seems, as far as one can tell from the clues that survive, basically to have run out of money. She had to leave London in order to earn her living, and it therefore took her much longer, until 1924, to complete her dining and be called. She did little, if any, legal practice thereafter, and in 1926 she emigrated to Sri Lanka to get married. So the money, the London home and so on, again, made a huge difference to Cobb's chances. So Cobb had fewer social, financial or familial constraints than many of her peers. In essence, she nonetheless faced persistent, significant sexism, but she fit into the profession in other important ways, including her age, politics and class. Because I've discussed how her family were better placed in terms of social capital than most of her colleagues. They were well connected with both the legal profession and the women's movement. And she seems to have been adept at using that social capital while carefully avoiding her father's notoriety. So in Sir Ernest Wilde's terms, she played the game, and her intrusion may not have been welcomed, but it was at least accepted. So there's no irony in the fact that Cobb is less well remembered than Helena Normanton, even though she was probably a more successful barrister, because her success was based on efforts to ensure that she didn't stand out. Does that mean that she was more astute at playing the career game than Normanton? Maybe. She certainly had more access through family connections to the unspoken rules of the bar, which Normanton quite often ran foul of. But she also lacked the wider commitment that Normanton had, which extended beyond her own career to improving access to the law for all women. So it maybe wasn't just astuteness, but also very much what her priorities were. So Cobb's greater long-term success compared with her cohort is certainly a tribute to her determination, her ability, and her ongoing fight against systemic sexism. And I really, really don't want to downplay that, because what she achieved was extraordinary. However, her class was also a crucial factor, and we must be careful to account for that when evaluating her alongside her less privileged peers. And that matters because it's an important reminder of the complexity of women's lives and experiences, as well as the multiple barriers to professional success which they faced then, and in fact still face now. So I'm delighted this evening to be part of this year of celebrating an important centenary for women, but we do also need to be careful to look at the continuing discrimination faced by many women, even a century after the profession was opened to them. Thank you.